Now we're going to do the story of the spies. Okay, intrigue. All intrigue. Okay, now it's in Bamidbar.
That is Numbers chapter 13, Tawaf.
Also, the story is told in two places. The story is told in Tawaf and then also is told in Malki. So it's also told in the Bible. That's part of Moshe's rebuke. I don't know. The story of the spies is a very significant story, because what's so significant about it? It's a major event. It's a major episode. Why is it so important? Because, yeah, I mean, it's a, I would say, a major catastrophe or setback. The Jews were supposed to enter the land quickly, right, immediately, as soon as possible, after the receiving of the Torah and so forth, within a reasonable amount of time with God's plan for them to enter and conquer the land. And because of the event which occurred with the spies, so this is a tremendous setback. It was a very serious sin. Not only that generation, it prevented that generation from entering the land. They were not allowed to enter the land. They held back the process 40 years, but it's a significant sin, which affects a sin like that, by the way, as you see, maybe not tonight, but as you see, it's not just that generation, but there are different kinds of sins. There are sins which affect an individual, and he does tshuva, and basically that's the end of that. Hopefully he doesn't pass it on to his children. But certain national kind of sins are of a different character, and they haunt, they can affect the people for many, many generations to come. And you see in Tanakh, you see that this sin is referred to again many times, so that it is something which, it's not just 40 years, but it took many, many years for the Jews to overcome that sin. And now that you think about it, proof of that is the fact of the Gullus today. We're in exile today because of the sins that were committed a long time ago. There were two exiles. The first exile only lasted about 70 years. That was because of the sin of what? The first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of the sin of Avodah Zarah, idolatry. So the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. And the exile was 70 years. So the Jews did tshuva. After the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, the second temple, we no longer read about overt Avodah Zarah, idolatry, which was rampant in the period of the first temple. The second temple, which has been destroyed, and the exile, which we're still in, an exile much longer, 2,000 years, of the 2,000 years, was for what sin? Sinat Chinam. And that, apparently, well, it's not, that was the main Avera, but obviously it carries with it other Avera, but whatever it is, we have not done tshuva for. Because the Rama mentions, the Torah does talk about that as well, and it says that it'll be the Achrat HaYamim in the end of days, the Shafta Adar Hashem Elokecha, and you will return to the Lord your God, and then God will have mercy upon us, and God will remove us from the state of exile. So the Rambam says that we have a clear promise from God that the exile will not come to an end until the Jews are tshuva. So therefore, apparently the Jews as a nation have not done tshuva to the extent that we're worthy of being. So we're still in a state of exile. And that's something that's important to remember. Now, let's take a look at the story. Because everybody today, there's this whole, tremendous fixation and obsession with Mashiach. Tremendous sensitivity to that. I'm sorry? Big issue. Well, every event that occurs is viewed in the context of Mashiach. And there's a tremendous amount of distortion because everybody has this preconceived notion that it's got to happen soon, so therefore whatever happens, and people come up with like wild stuff. And go, well, the Persian Gulf War. But it's not just that. I remember, well, in the Six-Day War, that was a tremendous period of messianic expectations. And I'm not saying that it's not, by the way. I'm not taking a position. I'm only saying that I don't know. I'm following the Rambam that we won't know until it actually is. The Rambam says there are specific signs by which we can know or have an idea that it's on the way. So other than that, we don't know. Nobody knows for sure. And people act today as though they know for sure. But recently, with the events in the Gulf, you know, the same types of things, and the Scud missiles, you know, that was, I heard some wild stuff. People were going around saying, giving speeches and everything, that the fact that Israel was hit by Scud, and there was such a casualty, that's a miracle, and that, well, that's okay, I mean, everyone was saying that. But then they said that there were 39 attacks on Israel. And the reason, by these experts, was because, you know, the, if you know, Makos, lashes, the punishment of lashes, Makos, for certain sins, you get 39. So God owes, yeah, so it's like, so they know. It's like, so therefore we only got 39, because that's all, I mean, it's just, the problem is people don't focus upon the other idea. The key idea is that God did promise us that there will be a redemption, there will be a Mashiach, and that is really related to Tshuva. That when the Jewish people as a whole do Tshuva and return to God in truth for the right reasons, then that is the guarantee. That's the only guarantee. That's the only way in which we can hasten the coming of the Mashiach. All right, you all have a place. By Dabra Hashem on Moshe Lamor, and God spoke to Moshe and said, Send for you men, Anushim, men. And the implication of Anushim, as Rashi points out, is that whenever it uses that term, it's not just anybody, but Hashuvim, important people. The leaders, as we will see. The Yasuru Eseret Canaan, and they shall buy out the land of Canaan that I'm giving to Bnei Israel. One man from each tribe shall you send, each one a prince, which means the leader of the tribe. All right? So, that's pretty obvious. And Moshe sent them out from Midbar Paran by the command of God. Again, Kulam Anashim, all of them significant people. But these are the leaders, as Rashi says. Whenever he uses the term Anashim, it's an expression of Chasivus, importance. And the Yoto Shok Sherim Hayim. At that time they were Sherim, which means they were righteous. That was before they sinned. These were the leaders. And that also should, that's also a sobering thought, that this is one of the most serious averos that was committed in our history and was done by the great leaders of the people, so that even the most kosher, the most righteous people, as we learn in Pesach, are Al-Kam and Biyashmacha, do not believe in yourself, Adyam Mosha. No one can ever feel righteous. No one can ever feel spiritually complacent. That's a good question. Fittingly enough, except one shaver was not represented. It goes through quickly. Vela Shmosam, the Maseruv, and it mentions the names of them, which again is an indication that they were significant people. What tribe do you think? No. Which would you... Levi was omitted. Yeah, well, that question. No. They... Hold on. First of all, not everybody that went sinned, because Yoshua and Kalev went and did not sin. Now, Shevet Levi was not represented. But so what if they don't get land? But still, they were part of the... You mean they didn't partake in the war? Is that what you're saying? How do you know that? In war? Is that true? No, they didn't inherit, they didn't, it's true. That the Shevet Levi was not given a portion of the land in terms of inheritance, because they received their sustenance from the tribe. Their task, each tribe was designated for different tasks, that's the way the nation was established. Shevet Levi was Their mission was to be to serve and be based on the Gushim, to teach the Torah, basically. That's what they were supposed to be involved in. So therefore they were not given an inheritance, a specific inheritance. However, I didn't know that they were thus exempted from war. I'm not sure, I've never heard that one before. So I have to put the point, but I have to look into it. I don't think they were. Now, but they were omitted, even so, I think it's a good question as to why they were omitted from the spying mission. I don't see why, if they couldn't perform that service. Offhand, I think it requires a further explanation. Thanks, Chad. The plane shutters, they were sent out to fly. Although, let's take a look at the... All right, this is the third law sure comes. Well, we're going to take it up. Let's give us a chance to judge. That's where the word comes from. You should not be drawn after your heart and your eyes. When you're pulled after. Yeah, well, there's no answer. You never had a problem with that. You can have a lot of problems by assuming that all of a sudden there was a need to just take a tour of the land and advance. Let's take a look at the mission. So these are the names of the men that Moshe sent out. Losteres Oret. Okay, you don't want to say to spy out the land, to search out the land. Whatever word you want to use. Then, by Yitro Moshe Loshea Ben Nun Yoshua. That's very interesting. Out of nowhere, he decides to change his name from Hosea to Yehoshua. And Rashi says there was an implication. Rashi says, his follower love, that he prayed for him. May God save you from the Atas Moraglim, from the idea, from the conspiracy, so to speak, of the Moraglim. So here Rashi is referring to them, Moshe is already referring to them as Moraglim. But this is, okay, but this is difficult anyways, because what does it mean? Does this mean that Moshe already had knowledge that they had some kind of a plot before he sent them? That implication cannot be taken literally. Here's again, a clear cut case where you have to realize that you can't take everything that Rashi says literally. We have to try and interpret it. So Moshe had certain misgivings. That we can say. Moshe had misgivings about this. Then it says that Moshe sent them out to search out the land of Canaan. He said to them, go up by the Negev. So they were encamped in the Sinai, obviously. You know a little bit of geography today. And the Negev is the southern part of Israel, which leads into the Sinai wilderness. And then go up the mountain, and you shall see the land, what it is, and the people that dwells on it, whether they are strong or weak, whether they are few, whether they are many. And what is the nature of the land that they are living on, whether the land is good or bad. And the cities that they are dwelling therein, whether they are encamped, or whether they are fortified, just plain camps, or whether they're very strongly fortified. And what is the land? Again, the nature of the land, is it shmenemi fat, which means it's a prosperous, yeah, right, productive, prosperous, or thin. In other words, whether it's poor, abundant or poor. Trees, whether there are trees therein or not. And strengthen yourself and take from the fruit of the land. And the days were the time of the flowering of the vineyard. Okay. Now this is very, very strange. And I could see, Jan, where you can get the idea that this is not a flying mission. Although, in Moshe's instructions, and this is one of the questions, that I would ask. Let's stop at this point before we go into this. This is the prelude. And this is the mission. What questions should we ask? We have the Varim. If not, just listen. If you have, you want to follow. This is repeated, but in the condensed form. It's part of the Tochacha. Moshe's rebuke. In Varim Perek Aleph, Pasuk of Beis. If I think of an Eli Kulchem, and you all approached me, and you said, Nishlacha Anashim Lefanenu, let us send men before us, the Yachburu Lanu Asara. That's a different term than the Asura, the Yachburu, and dig out. The Choker is to dig out, to search out the land. The Yashivu Osano Davar, and bring back a report to us. It's a Derech Asher Naleba, the road that we should go up therein, and the cities that we should come unto. This is totally different. It's clear from this. First of all, there's a contradiction. Story in Bamidbar implies that this was at the command of God, that God commanded them. The story, as Moshe retells it, is there's something different, that you approached me, and you requested it. And the request was the Yachzur Lanu. The request there does not mention this idea of Losur, which you want to take to mean not aspiring, which we're talking about, anyway, that the word losur could also, in other words, it would, it's not maybe specifically only a flying mission, but it certainly would include that, but whatever. Here it's the Yachulon, to dig out, to search out, and to bring back a report concerning the road that we should enter and the cities that we should go to, which seems to be pretty much military intelligence, which is the normal thing to do, because they have to wage a war. They have to wage a war, and it's only national. I mean, before you wage a war, you have to send out spies. As we see, in point of fact, that the idea of sending out spies is a correct idea, and it wasn't a crazy idea, because before they actually did enter 40 years later, after Moshe had died, and under Yoshua sent out spies. Yoshua sent out spies and brought back a report. And the report basically was the state of the people. They would, right? You know, the whole story was the Rachab. Rachab took them in. She was a righteous woman. And they brought back a report as to the state of the situation and so forth. So, here, they are requesting a spy. Vayitav v'ein hadavah. And the matter was good in my Moshe was satisfied. Moshe had no problem with it. And I chose from you 12 men. Ishechad l'shavet. One man. So Moshe chose. Here we see clearly that Moshe chose somebody. Or whether it was volunteers, Moshe chose. And we'll soon see that Rashi has a different. I'm going to be following more or less. There's different opinions on this. The Ramban has his opinion. I'm going to be following Rashi, and Rashi based himself on the opinion of Chazal. Chazal's interpretation tonight. And then it goes on with the story. Vayifte vayal ohara. And that he turned and went up the mountain, and he came to Nachal Eshkol. And what does it say after that? On Pasuk of Dalet, if you have that, Jan, what does it say? Bayir Raglu also. They have a Raglu. And spider. Okay. It says that you took the fruit of the land and brought it down to us, and brought us back a report, and you said the land was very good. I'm not going to go into that stuff. That's part two. Part two is what actually occurred. The Chayham Rakan. I don't know if we're going to be able to get into that tonight. But the essence, the substance of the story is really, what is the Chayham Rakan? What was their sin? Okay, what was their sin? But, what was the nature of this thing? What was it? It's not that clear. Alright, let's go back. Let's go back for a second. I want to get at the whole story before I concentrate on the question. Let me go a little bit further. Go back now to Bamidbar. Bear with me a bit. So Moshe gave them their instructions. And basically the instructions seem to encompass two separate ideas. Certain ideas pertain to military strategy, right? He wants to know about the people. Are they strong or weak? He wants to know about the cities. Are they fortified or just plain camps? That is military information. At the same time, he's also asking them to find out about the land, whether it's good, whether it's not good, whether it's productive, whether it's abundant, whether it's sparse. And not only that, but he asks them to strengthen themselves and to bring back some of the fruit, which seems to be completely out of rule. That does not seem to have any military, this type of information does not seem to have any military value whatsoever. In terms of what? We'll have to ask what the point of that is. Why they should be given such an option in the first place? Why they should even be such an option? Now let's hold off for a second on that. So they went up. Let's proceed with the story. What happened here? So you get a whole picture. Now we're back to Chafalot now in Bamidbar. That's Yud Gimel Chafalot. So they went up and they spied out the land, or toured out the land, whatever you want to say. Bamidbar turned into Rechol Levol Chamah. And they went up to Negev, they went to Hebron, and there was these powerful people, Achiman, mentioned Sheshai, Salmai, and so forth. And Hebron had been built for 7 years before, so on, and Siam. Then they came to Nachal Eshkol, and they cut off from there, grapes, a whole bunch of grapes. And they had to carry it on a pole. And they took the pomegranates and dates. They brought back, here's where they fulfilled the instruction of Moshe to bring back the fruits of the land. Then they called it Nachal Eshkol because of the grapes that they took back. Okay, so then they returned from the tour of the land at the end of 40 days. Okay, at the end of 40 days. Then they came, and they stood before, they came back before Moshe and Aaron and all of the congregation of Israel, to Midbar Paran in Kadesh. And they brought them back to the report and the entire, for the entire congregation. And they showed them the fruits of the land. And they spoke to them, and they said, "We came to the land that you sent us to. And also, it is a land which flows milk and honey. And here is its fruit. However, the nation is the nation that dwells there is powerful, and the cities are very powerfully fortified, and also the Yelidei Ha'anak, the descendants of the Anak, you know, these powerful people we've seen there. Amalek dwells in the land of the Negev," and Rashi says that was like a subtle way of scaring them, because they knew already. They'd been burned, Rashi says, by Amalek, which would be the first people they would encounter. And the Sisi, Yishivi, Amori, etc. are in the mountains, and the counties by the sea, and by the Jordan. And then, Kaleb, like, shushed them, Bayam, he shushed them. He told them, he tried to get them to be quiet. And he says, "We will go up there, and we will inherit it, but we will be able to do so." And the people that went up with him said, "We will not be able to go against the people, for they are very mighty." And they brought back, a report about the land that they had toured to the Jewish people, and saying, "The land that we've gone over to tour it out is a land which eats up its inhabitants. And all of the people that we saw there are men of measure." In other words, mighty people, big people. "And we saw these giants, the Bnei Anak, from the Nephilim, these are the ancient people who are very mighty, and we were like grasshoppers in their eyes, and so, in our eyes and in their eyes." All right, then, in chapter 14, that's when these people begin to panic. Then the entire people lifted their voices, they began to cry that night, that whole night, and they began to complain, and then the rebellion comes forth, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt," and so forth, "Why did God bring us there," etc. We don't have to go into every part of it. So there's many questions that we can ask about this. There's many questions. This is part two. Part two is the story of the sin. Let's go back and let's see if we can be a little bit methodical and orderly. Let's start with the mission itself. It seems, well, you mentioned before that there's a, you know, obvious contradiction between the way the story is presented in Shalach and the way it's presented in Devarim. Whose idea was it? In Shalach, it appears to be the command of God. Shalach Chanash, and to you, man. God is commanding. In Devarim, however, it appears that the people required it, the people requested it, of Moshe, and Moshe agreed. In fact, Moshe says it was good in his eyes. He approved of it. It seems that, so it seems in Devarim that it was good, that the whole idea was good, and that it initiated with people. Alright. Now, what about the mission itself? It's clear, then, from the bottom, that what the people requested was for military purposes. Send men to spy out the Yahshua, to spy out the land, because we're going to be fighting a war, we're going to have to conquer it. So we're ready. Let's just send forth spies. If that is the case, then what's problematical about this story that we've read tonight, the Shalach? What's the problem? In other words, everything over here is now problematical, because all the spying missions, if you read Tanakh, you see that from time to time they sent out spies and they've had two battles. Of course, the classical one is the one that they sent into Jericho. Whenever there's a flying mission, they don't send out 12 people. They send out usually two. One, two, you don't want... Essentially, there's no connection whatsoever between the sin of Miriam, who spoke Lashon Hara about Moshe, explained about Moshe, that why is Moshe separated from his wife? That was the essence and the sin of the tribe, who their sins seem to be that they were overcome by fear. By fear of the mighty giants that they're seeing. So on the surface, it does not seem to be a connection. But there is, in fact. That's a different context. Let's just deal with this. Okay. This is brought up. But let's, let's for the time being assume that it's valid to have a spying mission. On the surface, it doesn't seem to be that bad. It definitely was a spying mission. See, the whole purpose underlying the mission, certainly there'd be no reason to let's come before we go and what? And we have to have a tour and demarcate. It's a military. It would seem to be. Oh, it started out as a military. See, I'm learning just the opposite. If anything, it started out, it was initiated as a military mission, but somehow Moshe changed the nature. If it's a spying mission, why do you need 12 people? That's my first question. Everything is problematic. Why do you need 12 people, A? B, it seems a little funny. Who do you send out on a spying mission? You don't send out the leaders. You have 12 state governors. You're not going to send out the governor, right? You send out soldiers. You send out scouts. All right. Now, it's true that in those days, generally speaking, the leaders were also powerful men, physical, and David HaMelech led the nation in war. But still, in all, for a spying mission, you don't send out the Nazis. Well, we'll see. It's funny that they would be forced to the entire people. All right. We want to understand what we want to understand is why they sent out 12, why they were the leaders, and also why it took 40 days, and why they, if the mission is a military mission, so why was there so much interest in the nature of the land, about the productive capacity of the land, about the agriculture, and so on and so forth, and also the strange request to bring back fruit. Why did they need to see the fruits of the land? All these things seem to be out of place, seem to be difficult. Yes? I thought that the prime task that was before them was to conquer the land. The fact that the land was a good land, that the land was a land which flows milk and honey, God had told them that way back when. When Moshe first came to them, and he told them that God spoke to them, and I'm going to take you out of Egypt, and I'm going to bring you up to a land which is very good, a land which flows milk and honey. So God had promised them that they would be brought to a good land. And they shouldn't have had any problems as far as that is concerned, that the land will be something which will meet their needs. There is no indication at this point that was troubling them, because they didn't complain. You'd imagine they want to get out of the desert and get settled in their land. What was an issue was the conquest, that they'd have to conquer.
No, but
problem with that, one second. I just saw the problem with what you're saying. That they, one second, that, not, that they had a lack of emunah. But so Moshe had no choice. But then how you gonna deal with the Devarim where it says, by Yisav Vien Hadavah. But most of it was very good. You're going to have these problems now. If you deal with all the facts, and you want a consistent idea, you're telling me now that the people were insecure. Moshe plus had a moon. How could Moshe not have a moon in God's word? You can't say that. But the people. But if the people, that's the word, now you can have this issue of your problem. But then you're going to tell me that the people had a legitimate request for a legitimate spying intelligence mission, which was supposed to confirm. So then, why did Moshe change it? Moshe, I believe, is the one who changed the nature of the mission. And he's the one, not that it started out as, I'm thinking it's the opposite of the theory that you came up with. It started out as Meraglim. They were supposed to be spies, and that was fine, by Yitzhak Zian Yadova. However, it ended up being something else. Not just, it ended up being Meraglim, spies, because they brought back a report that reported on two things: military information and the layout, the mountain, no, not the mountain, but the layout of the land, something like that. Agronomy, I don't know. The nature of the land and the fruit, the quality of the land. Two things. Now, one thing I understand: military. The other thing, well, this isn't at the conflict. They'll conquer the land, then they'll send out the agricultural experts to check out. To check out where is it good for this shavit, where is it good for that shavit, and don't they have faith that there's enough in this land to satisfy everybody? I don't understand. I don't understand why, to bring back the fruits of the land, they have to actually see the fruit. Now, and also we have that contradiction that was pointed out between who initiated it. In Shalach, it seems to be God. In Devarim, it seems to be the people. I would agree with you that it's a good thing. It's very approaching irrationally, as long as we're limiting it to the military. But to start doing a whole investigation as to whether it's a no, whether it's a no, why not? Rashi and Shalach Makar. Rashi and Shalach Makar says, Shalach Lacha. The implication is Lacha for you. Now that term sometimes implies that it's for you, but not for me. It's not my idea. So Rashi says, well, that's according to your desire or request. Ani Eini Mitzava Lacha. I am not commanding you to do it. So Rashi says that this term Shalach Lacha stands for you, is I'm giving you permission. In other words, I'm not commanding you, I'm giving you permission. In Tirta, Shalach, if you desire, then you can send. See, here's where Rashi resolves the contradiction between Dvarim and Lefisha Bo Yisrael. Because the Jews came, the Amru, and they said, Nikwed in Dvarim Aleph, the puppet quote before. Mishlecha Hashem Lefanenu, let us send men before us. Kamash Nehemar, Vatikr V'Nailai Kochem, as it says, you all gathered before me. Moshe Nimlach Peshchina. And Moshe consulted with God. Amar, he said, that is what God said. Ani amati lahem shitova. I said to them that it's good. Shenemra, he says, Allah eschem me'onim Mitzrayim. I will bring you up from the affliction of Egypt, etc. With the end of that part, you get to a land which flows, and to a land which is goodly, and flows milk and honey. So I told them it's a good land. Chayehem, by their life, shani nosim ha'makom litos. I'll give them a place where they can have. I'll give them the opportunity to fail. But Divrei Hamaraglam, concerned with the matter of the spies, Laman lo Yeshua, so that they shouldn't inherit. This is very, very wild. This only makes it even more. You see what he's saying? In other words, he's giving them the opportunity to fail. You want it? You came and you requested. You requested spies. So therefore, this Rashi, based on Chazal, which I'll read to you in full, resolves the contradiction. It's an attempt to resolve it. In the Varn it says, the truth is that it originated with them. They came and said, let us send out spies to spy out the land. And Moshe endorsed it. And Rashi points out over there, in my eyes it was good, but not in the eyes of God. So already, Rashi is pointing out to us that there was a difference. Moshe saw it one way, of course God saw it a different way. And what was God's objection? What was God's objection? God's objection was that there's no need for this. So God did not agree with everybody in the room here who thought that there was a need to have advanced information. There's no need for it. Because what do you have to check it out? What do you have to check it out for? I told you it's good. Isn't that enough for you? Now, God had told them in many places, just for it once, but all through Dvarim, filled with quotations, that the land that I bring you to is a land which is very goodly and this and that. And all these phrases of the land. So you know it's a good land. If God tells you it's a good land, you have to test that yourself. I would say it wouldn't be, it would be wrong. Definitely be wrong. Now the other part is not so clear. Whether the request for spies, there is controversy. No. That's not blind faith. No. That's not blind faith. That is not blind faith.
Why?
No. Because, in fact, when Abraham, the full praise of Abraham, when he left El Arad and Shareka, to leave your homeland and your fatherland, go to the land, and also God didn't even tell him what land it was. That was to increase the reward. But he went not even knowing, not even having a picture. In contrast, this would be that Abraham, for Abraham, it was enough to know that that's the land that I picked for you, good enough. Didn't have to know anything about it, even what land it was, the name of the land. the Jews, God didn't expect the Jews to be on that level, so God told them, I'm going to take you to the land of Canaan, it's a goodly land, a land which flows. God told them all that. Now, if you have Hashkacha from God to go and live in that land, you mean, in that case, you wouldn't have to check out the land. To check out the land yourself would smack of denial, a lack of amunah. Because what is there to check out? Well, what is blind about that? That's not blind faith. That's the most clear. You know that God tells you it's the best. Can't be anything clearer than that. I don't understand why he's calling it blind faith. He asked this question. And I'm not going to answer this for the moment. Whether the request the spies from a purely militaristic point of view, whether that's what they're doing or not, that is not such a simple thing. That could be viewed as rational, but there are those who disagree with that too. There's other opinions on that too. I'm not going to... I'll bypass that for the time being. Because whether they should have relied on the unknown, they were being led by the unknown. That is to say, throughout their journey in the wilderness, they didn't have to spy out in advance. They had the cloud. The cloud by day, and the cloud of fire by night, the pillar of fire, so that would show them the way to go. So it's not clear. It's not clear. But at least for the time being, I think it's, for the time of the Ramban holds definitely that the request for spies was good. Was valid, was legitimate for a military, because their mission was to conquer the land. And once I do, now you have to carry it out in the most speedily. You have to use rationale. You have to use chachma. In other words, whenever you're given a mission to perform, even if you know that God is with you, you can't rely on miracles. Ain't so colony. You cannot rely on miracles. So if you can't rely on miracles, you have to fight and you have to use strategies. And part of strategy is fight. So that part of it was good. So now we have to sort of work it out. From the Devarim, it appears that the request of the people was legitimate. They wanted to move, so they wanted to have spies. And that's why Moshe agrees. So Moshe takes counsel with God. That's the counsel of God. And God gives a very strange response over here. Because God does not prevent, but God says, okay, if you need it, I'll let you do it. But it's not going to be good. It's not going to be good for you. I'm going to give you a place to sin or to fail. Now where? When? What? Where is the thing? And God accuses them over here of fear. It seems to be fear. A denial. But where? In requesting, they seem to be ready to go ahead. Where does God see in this? We have two questions. Where do we see in this that there's any lack of emunah in the goodness of the land? A. And B, if that is the case, and it was wrong for them, so then God should have said no. Why didn't God agree? No. God should not have agreed to the mission. All because God should have said no. There's no
reason.
God didn't say no. God said, I'm giving you for sure. But God should have said no. Absolutely not. But why would God give them the space to sin? Well, I mean, one could ask, if God knows if it's wrong, God could have nixed it. Why would God allow them to get themselves into a situation like this? In other words, why didn't God come back? Well, Moshe was Zimlah. Moshe asked God, right? Moshe wanted to know. Now, I mean, it seems to me, if God said that it was wrong, God should have given them Musa and said that, what are you talking about? I told you it's a good land. You should have confidence in what I said, and that's it, no spies. But God comes back with a saying, okay, you don't really need this, but if you must, I'll let you have it, and I'm going to give you, you'll see, I'll give you room to really have a big Mapala over here, like a warning. It's a funny kind of thing. Yes, the problem, the main problem, which we'll probably take up next week, is, if you read the story, what we don't even see in the what we read, where is the sin of the spies? What did they do wrong? Ramban asked this question himself. It seems like they spoke the truth. Whatever they said apparently was true. They didn't make any lies. They did their mission. Their mission was to get answers to these questions. Take a look at the part of your assignment for next week. This is the Midbar Rabbah. And this elaborates, Rashi just quoted very briefly from this, but this elaborates on the quote of Rashi. Alright? Now, it's just like this. Even though God said to them, Shlach HaRavim, dead man, it wasn't from God. God really that they should go. God didn't really want them to go.
Why?
Because God had already told them the praise of the land. And a quote, for God will bring you to a good land, and so forth. The land you're coming to inherit is a goodly land, etc. And it's just, you know, all the quotes that I've mentioned already. So, what does it mean for them? What does it mean to send? Why does God say, send to you, man? But rather, the Jews requested these things. Because at the time when it came to inherit the land, God said to them, see, God has given you this land. See this land that God has given you. At that time, the Jews came before, they approached before Moshe. It says, as it says, you all came before me. And this is what, and then he quotes, and this is what it says in Ezra. They didn't listen to your commandments, and they refused to listen, and they didn't remember your wondrous things. So that's what it means, in other words. When they came before him, it means they didn't, they forgot all the great things that God had did. And that's why they said, let us send out, they forgot. So they had to send out men to search out the land. Well, I shall lo have me, they didn't believe. Alright? Now, Rabbi Yeshua says, there's a number of rabbis of the Gemara commenting it. So what were they compared? To a king that prepared for his son a beautiful woman for a wife, who was very beautiful and good and wealthy, a rich one. So the king said, this is the analogy. This is the analogy of the case. I have designated for you a beautiful and goodly and wealthy woman for a wife. So what does the son say? Let me go and see. Anyway, the arrow, sir. I want to go and see. I want to go and see myself. Shlohaya mom and the other. He didn't believe his father. Okay? So immediately, the father was very hurt, was very dead. He was very dead to the father. The father said, what should I do? Well, he didn't know what to do. If I will say, so now the father is going to have gone. In other words, there's a marshal over here. The father prepared a beautiful wife for the son, and the son wanted to see the man he could see for himself. So now the father says, what am I supposed to do? If I don't let him see it, right now, he'll say that she's ugly. That's why he doesn't want me to see. So therefore, in the end, he said to him, okay, you can see her and see whether I deceive you or not. But because you didn't believe me, then I take a vow that you'll never see her in your house, but I'll give it to your son. Okay? To his grandson, to your son. Alright, so that's kind of strange. A little weird. So that's exactly what happened. Exactly what happened. The guy said, you want to see it? You want to see it? I'll let you see it. But you won't get to see it, and your children won't see it. That's the muscle. That's the muscle. The cock. So too, God said to Israel, the land is good. They didn't believe. But rather they said, let us send forth men before us to spy it out. Which, as I said, is strange, because to spy it out means militarily. You see, it's like a little bit funny over here. Where do we see that they're denying that the land is good? So God said, if I stop them, that's the answer, David, that's where the answer question is being answered. Well, I'm going to give you room. So God was sort of in a bind, so to speak. If I stop them, if I say no spies, so they'll say, because it's not good. That's why God didn't go let them see it. But let them see it. Ubishpur. And I take an oath that not one of them will enter. As we see, God, that was the punishment that no man from that generation would enter. But to the children will I give it. Alright? Okay. So what's the chat over here? Let's see what's the chat. On the one hand, it seems that their request was legitimate. Because because they did not request, their request did not include anything about bringing back the fruits and so on and so forth. All right? Did not. But nevertheless, and therefore in the eyes of Moshe, it was good. In the eyes of Moshe, it was good. But God was not pleased with it, and nevertheless, God allowed them to do it. So what do you think that was going to do? In other words, the way I understand it, their state of mind has to be understood on two. They were functioning on two different levels. There's the conscious level. Now, on the conscious level, it was a legitimate request. It made sense, and that's why I believe that Moshe said, "But you have the Ani Adav." In my eyes, it was good because Moshe was looking on it on the conscious level. On the conscious level, and in their own mind, they were not involved in any deceit, but rather they were doing the rational thing. That if we have to conquer, we have to fight a war, so then we have to get information. But God saw that it wasn't just that. See, a person can do the rational thing, and sometimes his motivation is purely the rational, but sometimes he has other, lowish ones. He has other motives. Sometimes a person is involved in doing good deeds, or doing good deeds, but he has an agenda. Now, why is he doing these good deeds? It could be that he's with smart, could be he has many other reasons. Then why do you think he'd like to be involved in this particular charity and in people and business, whatever? Who knows? There's all kinds of possible reasons. There are many, many stuff that all kinds of infighting and breakups and this and that and fights when people are trying to do good things. How could it be? Well, the answer is that there are very often it's a cover for other desires. So, the thing is like this, that apparently this was, I mean, as the Lord points out, this generation, this was a very big challenge. These people had been enslaved, and they had to overcome the slave mentality. And the most difficult thing for people who've been enslaved is to really stand up and fight. Be able to stand up and fight for themselves. Even when they fought against the Amalek, I mean, they were only able to fight when Moshe's hands were raised in prayer to God, and they looked at Moshe. They needed strength. So this was a tremendous test. But God saw that in order for them to gather, to have sufficient strength, they had a tremendous resistance, to have sufficient strength to fight the war, they needed something more than just their commitment, their idealism. They needed the attachment to the land. The attachment to the land was a motivating factor. It was the lowest one. Yeah, it's the lowest one. In other words, the person can have a mixed motive. He's doing the right thing. He wants to do the right thing, but in order to do the right thing, he has to have a certain amount of gratification of the physical as well. Alright? So far, that's not so terrible, though. In other words, the fact of the matter is that they were not on the level that they would just go and fight a war for this land, not knowing anything about the land. Because it's too dangerous, and they're afraid, and they don't have the positive incentive. Now, people will take risks. You see, people will take risks. People are sometimes, very often, crazily. People will endanger themselves and they'll go out in crazy weather if it's like money. Let's say they left something behind, they lost a ring, this, that, they'll do crazy things that they ordinarily wouldn't do. Now, why? It's not rational. But because the tithe gets them. So sometimes you need a certain amount of tithe. Avraham Avinu didn't have to know about the land. But the Jews did have to know. And there was nothing wrong. How do I know that there was nothing wrong? That God did not expect the Jews to simply go and fight a war for a land. But he told them before. Exactly. That's exactly the problem. Exactly the problem. That is one. Well, wait one second. Let me just finish the point. Then we'll have to. Exactly. It should have been enough that God told them that it's a land that flows milk and honey. It's a good land. It's broad land. It has all your needs. So now you're not being asked to just go out and fight a war to kill the shmub, but to also have the incentive that you're going to have a nice. That emotion will be satisfied as well. So what's the problem? Why wasn't that enough? What do we see? What was the defect of the Jews? God told them that God expected them to be able to raise themselves to the level that they wouldn't need anything more. That they wouldn't need the actual visual. That they wouldn't need the tangible. Now what is the fate over here? Okay, so it's a lack of emunah. So what caused this lack of the moon? What was beneath this lack of the moon? What does it show about the state of the Jews? Well, what slave? No. The slave mentality. Not everything. Yeah, why did he do something physical? Think of an analogy in your own life. Think of an analogy. What about the analogy? What's the name? What about the analogy? The analogy with the father, the king, and the. That's a very instructive analogy. The father, right? The father, whom the child has any reason, why? The father tells the son, "I picked out a beauty for you." Why does that? What would determine? When you will believe, there are certain cases. Well, let me just set it up. There are certain cases. Yeah, right. There are certain cases when you believe. For example, with anyone in your life, whether it's your husband or your father, right? Certain things you want. You're looking for a car. You're looking for an apartment. This, that. There are certain cases where, in Florida, wherever it may be, they'll describe it to you. You trust them. We go ahead. Then there are certain cases where you got to see for yourself. Okay? Now what would determine? When it is that you can, when you would rely on somebody, and when it is when you wouldn't, and you must see. What is that? I must see for myself. Ah. You see? Wouldn't you say it's the level of taiva? In other words, exactly. When a person has a rational attitude towards the thing in question, they act in a very rational way. In other words, the person needs something. What level is he on? He needs a house. He needs certain physical things. If the entire involvement is from a rational standpoint, he's really attached his idea. In other words, he's looking for the good. Each person is searching for the good. So when God took them out of the triumph, it was to bring them into a good situation, so they could experience the true good. That God wanted them to be attached to the idea of the good in a rational, intelligent way. In that framework, so then of course each thing has its place, it's important, right? It has to be, you need a home, you need certain things. Now when a person is involved in the rational, then he acts in a rational way, and he doesn't have this obsessive need to see for himself. So when it comes to your own taiva, when it comes to a fantasy, the person builds up a whole fantasy, then he can't trust anyone. Then he's got to see for himself, because he's got to see whether it fits the fantasy. That's a lower level. And he can't trust. The inability to trust somebody else is because this is not a rational thing anymore. This is my fantasy. I've got to see. Only by seeing will I be convinced. Will I say. So it means to say that the Jews should have been on a level. God did not expect them to be on the level of Abraham, where they didn't have any need to know about the land. Just follow blindly anyway. But they should have been on a level where once they were told that this is a land that flows milk and honey, it's a good land, they should have been able to relate to that, to the abstract idea of the good without the concrete. They have to see the concrete for that. God saw in this request that was dumb. That was dumb. This will explain the whole nature of the mission. So for Moshe saw the overt was good. It means to say that they're ready to get up, they're ready to move ahead, and they're acting rationally. They need spies. But God said, no, in your eyes it's good, not in mine. Because God knew that beneath it all there was a certain underlying emotion, which could lead to danger. Not that God was saying, I'm going to, you follow? They still had Bechira. They still had Bechira. But God saw that if you're going to give in to this emotion, then there's a tremendous opportunity for the danger over here. The danger, because you're not acting rationally. So that's why the mission changed. And the mission became a mission to bring back not just the military, but to convince them in a very concrete way that the land would satisfy their materialistic desires. And that's why it actually brought back the fruit of land. Because when you see, it engenders a certain connection. It engenders a certain attachment. And that's why you have to have the 12 leaders, you see? Because for military, you don't need the 12 leaders. But for the idea to describe the qualities of the land and the abundance and so forth, each tribe would be impressed by what their own leader had to say, and that's why Shevet Levi was excluded, because Shevet Levi was not involved in Nachla. So for them it was irrelevant. Their relationship to the land did not involve inheritance. They were not going to inherit anyway, so they were at a higher level altogether. Their whole relation to the land was a land which was good in terms of the abstract good. They knew that this land would satisfy them, would be good for them, would lead to a good life. But not because of their indulgence, not because of anything particular in a physical way about the land. You see, they didn't need the physical relationship with him. They were in a higher level. So they were excluded from the mission altogether. All right, I'll stop here on this point of the question. Jackie, right? In terms of God's will, yeah, there was no way out. Because had God nipped it, then they would not have had the strength, the courage to go in, because they wouldn't have had the incentive. See, on the one hand, we're operating on two different levels. On the one hand, they have a certain fear, and they have to overcome that fear. But apparently, the desire to follow God's command is not sufficient. They need a certain amount of strength from the attachment to the land. Look, they're only human. That's not so terrible. Okay? However, this should have been different. In other words, they should have been on the level where it's enough to know that it's a good land. You don't have to see the picture. Take my word, it's a good land. Okay? But God saw that they weren't. Now, once they were not on that level, then if he would have deprived them of their need to satisfy the emotion about the land, then they wouldn't have been able to fight. So therefore, in order to encourage them and give them the strength, God gave them the chance to actually satisfy that emotion. But then God, well, once I give you that chance, I'm creating an opportunity for you to fail. Then you're in a very, very dangerous situation. Would better off had you not even embarked upon this thing in the first place, you'd be much better off. You see, so God didn't facilitate this thing. God never facilitates this thing. They have Bechira. The Chazal was only telling us that the situation of the Jews was such that God really didn't have a choice. To deprive them would have prevented them altogether. So, okay, if you must see, I'll give you the chance to see. But know that in having the chance to see, you run a tremendous risk. Okay. What was the challenge of the generation of the desert and the generation of the tribe? What was their challenge? Which as we see that they really failed. Well, yeah, of course, but the ultimate challenge was to make a tremendous transformation. Yes, to go, and, you know, like, I don't think you really sometimes understand in a very concrete way what the characters in the Torah are going through. We tend to look down sometimes at the door. We can't understand how could they have seen all these miracles and yet still have rebelled. Understanding things on a superficial level. This was a very major challenge, to be able to extricate themselves from a slave mentality in a very short period of time and to become a conqueror. And that's not an easy thing to do. The experience of slavery, as you know, is not just a physical phenomenon, but it leaves a tremendous psychological impact on the person, and that itself is a miracle. The fact that the Jews were able to transform themselves from a slave, some people that was a slave, to free themselves from a slave mentality. And God expected them to do this in a relatively short period of time. They were supposed to be able, in a relatively short period of time, to go to war. Not just to go to war against someone who was attacking them. That they did against Amalek. And even then, they had a tremendous need for Moshe, as it says, as long as they saw Moshe Rabbeinu with his hands praying to God, that gave him strength. And when Moshe's hands went down, they became weaker. So without Moshe, they couldn't fight. So with Moshe, they could fight. But that was a war of defense. It's quite a different story to be able to become a conqueror, to actually launch a war of conquest, and to defeat as a nation, and to disinherit them, to throw them out of the land, and to take it over. That requires tremendous courage, and psychologically, a person with a feeling of defeat, in other words, with an attitude of a defeated individual can't do that. He just doesn't have the confidence. And that's basically what occurred to the tribe, that they could not overcome the slave mentality. However, the question is, did God expect them to muster the courage and to fight the battle purely for the sake of the commandments? In other words, were they on that level where they would find the courage and be able to fight just because of the commandment to take over the land? That was our question. And was the need of the Jews to know something about the character of the land, was that inherently wrong? So we said that they were not condemned for that. Because God, in criticizing them, says, I told them that it was good. I told them a bit about the land. It's a good land, the land which flows milk and honey. So therefore we see that when God had sent Moshe to them and outlined the plans for going out of Egypt, God realized that it was necessary for them to know what kind of land. If they wouldn't know what kind of land they were getting into, then they would not be able to fight. So they needed what we would call a lolishma, something, in other words, a motivation which stems from something outside of the mitzvah, an emotion. They needed an emotional attachment. They were not on the level of Abraham, who was ready to just follow God, to the land that I'll show you. They had to have to know that what kind of a land it would be. Their problem was that they were not satisfied with God, with the abstract conviction that it's good, but they had to actually form a concrete attachment. That's the mikshol. And God saw that they were on a lower level, that they needed to see for themselves and to get a first-hand report about the quality of the land in order to form the proper attachment. Alright? So this forms the... This explains everything. This explains the contradiction. That in Devarim, it describes that Moshe tells that it originated with the Jews, but he consulted with God, and Shlach HaNashim, the Lecha, to you. In other words, I'm allowing this. It implies that this is only because of your need, not because of objective necessity. Objective necessity, you should need it. And this explains why they had 12 men, why each one was the leader, because the objective was not just military information, but to reassure the Jews about the nature. They wanted a full report about the fauna and the flora. Yeah, both of them. I think you should have some readings, right, from information. Okay, the question is, why do I assume that Moshe can see that? Yes, the Einai Hayatav. In my eyes, it was good, but not in the eyes of God. No. Why would they need it? No, then he would criticize them. Why weren't they confident in God's word? In other words, Moshe's attitude should have been the same. I told them it's good. In other words, if Moshe recognized that it was due to this need, that it was actually there was a lack of amunah, then why would he think that that's good? He certainly wouldn't think it's good. Ain't I so? Good that they don't have enough amunah? So therefore I'm saying that Moshe didn't look at it that way. Moshe took it at face value. That it indicates that they're ready to fight. That's good. Now, the way I'm learning, it's disappointment, but the way I'm learning is that the instructions that Moshe gave them were from God. Because Shalach HaNashim, it's all part of that. Now, even though God did not, I mean, the Torah, in other words, the Torah over here does not tell us that God told them what the instructions were, I am assuming that God revealed to him exactly what the nature of the mission should be. That Moshe didn't make this up on his own. I'm assuming that. On chapter 13, verse 21, they went up and they spied out the land. Okay. From Midrash, from Rechav, etc. Then it says they went up to the Negev and they came to Hebron and they saw these gigantic people, these powerful people. Then they came to Nachal Eshkol and they took a cluster of grapes and they carried it on a pole, two people, and they took other pomegranates, dates, so forth. They went, they toured the land, they checked out the nature of the fruit, the nature of the people. They fulfilled the mission. And this is one of the questions that Ramban raises, because now we're going to study the actual return and what they did and wherein lies the sin. Because Ramban asked the question that we asked last week. It would seem on the surface that they executed the mission and they came back and they spoke the truth. Well, what did Moshe expect? That they would lie? They gave a very truthful report. If it is not what he wanted to hear, that's no fault of theirs. That's the question from Ramban. So let us look carefully now at what occurs when they come back. They return. See, at this point, the Torah doesn't indicate that there's anything wrong here. They return from the exploration, from their exploration of the land, at the end of 40 days. Okay? Yom Lashana, by the way. That's significant, because they spent 40 years in the wilderness, and there's a significance. It wasn't by accident, but Yom Lashana, right? every day, that 40 signifies the 40 days that they spent spying out the land, which is a lack of emunah. That's what it's worth. I need to see for yourself. They went, and they came to Moshe and Aaron, and to all of, section 26 now, and to all of the congregation of the children of Israel, Midbar Paran and Kodesh. That's basically, Kodesh is located in the northern part of the Sinai. The northern part of the Sinai. Right? The end of the Negev, basically. Would be where it is. And they brought back a report for the entire congregation, and they showed them the fruit of the land. Okay, so they brought back the report, they showed them the fruit of the land. Now let's get into the actual report. 27. And they said to him, they told over to him, and they said, "We came to the land that you have sent us to, and down, and also, yes, it's a land which flows milk and honey." And this is the truth, just like God said, it's a land which flows milk and honey. Now, it's very interesting. You see, they were very intelligent. They're very, very intelligent. Where do you see the their wisdom? Yeah. Well, first off, there. In other words, they wanted Yevagam. But in other words, they didn't start off with an attack. They were very subtle. They were very careful. Very nice land. We went there. We checked it out. It flows milk and honey. And here's the truth. So far, so good. However, the nation is strong that dwells in the land. And the cities are very fortified. And also the children of the Anak, that is a powerful people, like big giants, did we see there. Amalek dwells in the land of the Negev. And it wasn't by accident they chose to say that, because Amalek they already had been burned by. Rashi says, they are very subtle. Because they were burned by Amalek, he says the Meraglim mentioned them first in order to frighten them. Then the Hittites, the Yebusim, the Amori, they dwell on the mountains, and the Kani dwells by the sea and by the Jordan. Now, Vayahas Kalev Esa'on El Moshe. Now, an interesting thing occurs. Now, Kalev gets up and he, what does that mean, Vayahas Kalev? Take a look at Rashi. Hishtik as Kulam, he shut them up. He just jumps up now, Kalev, and he shuts them up. What did they say is wrong? All right. The fact they mentioned that, that's a subtle idea. That they mentioned Amalek, that's not an overt attempt. It's a very subtle thing that they mentioned at first, but there's nothing wrong in saying that. Everything they said so far is true. All right? But at this point, he steps up and he shushes them. And he says, "Although Nala the Arashnosa, we'll go up and we will inherit it. But we will be able to conquer it. We have the ability to do it." Now, it's not clear why is he jumping in at this particular point. And the men that had gone up with him said, "We won't be able to go up to the people, for they are too powerful for us." And then they brought out Dibasa. So that's phase number one in the thing. Phase number one. Then they brought out the evil talk about the land that they had explored to the Bnei Yisrael, saying, "The land that we went over, we passed through to explore it, is a land which eats its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw within it are men of measure." In other words, mighty men, powerful, big, neato, measure. "And there we saw the Nephilim, the Ne'anot, Minah Nephilim." That's a group of people who were big, powerful, giants. "And we were like grasshoppers in our own eyes." In other words, we felt like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and so too were we in their eyes. And that's basically it. And then the problems, that's it. That destroyed the people. The people began to cry. That threw them into a different state. They began to cry the entire night. And they complained against Moshe and Aaron, all the people of Israel, and said to them, "Look, would that we would have died in the land of Egypt or in this wilderness. would that we'd have died? And why did God bring us to this land to be destroyed by the sword? Our wives and our children will be as booty. It is better for us to return to Egypt. And each one said to his brother, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. So of course, this is just about the worst thing that they could possibly do. Complete refusal, complete rebelliousness. They'd rather, well, I guess you see, they'd even do two things. First, they said to why did God, they would prefer to die in the land of Egypt or to die in the wilderness rather than to fight. Which means that emotionally, the idea of dying at the sword was worse than. They'd rather just die in Egypt or die in the wilderness. But dying by the sword is worse. And then they say, then they go even further. And they say, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Then Moshe and Aaron fell on their faces before the entire congregation. And Yeshua, Benun, and Korah, those who were of the tribe, they rent their garments. They rent their garments. And they said to the congregation, they tried to salvage the situation. They said to the people of Israel, the land that we have passed over to explore it, Tova Arat Ma'od Ma'od, the land is very, very good. The land is very, very good. Now that would seem to be strange, because nobody questioned that the land was very good. And here they are, the whole situation is falling apart. The whole situation, well, yeah, it's not clear. You see, the whole situation is falling apart. And a last-ditch effort by Yoshua and Kohen to save it. So the first thing they say is, they sort of like refute them on the land. No, the land that we gone to was very, very good. Well, that's what the spies had said. They hadn't denied that. The very first communication was to tell them that we've come to the land, but Gam Zalat Kol Vidvash. So they hadn't... All right, then they added Tochel Gezveh. We'll have to find out what that is. Okay? And then it said they brought out the Dibas Ha'aretz. But it seems that it was very important to counter them on the point of Tova Ha'aretz Ma'od Ma'od. When Chavetz Banu Ad Hashem, if God finds desire in us, if God is pleased with us and wants us to be successful, Vehevi Ha'aretz Ma'od Ma'od Ha'aretz, then he'll bring us to this land and give it to us. Again, they repeat, a land which flows milk and honey. They keep repeating that. Which the spies had not denied. But, Ach Bashem Al Tinrodu, but don't rebel against God. And you do not fear the people of the land, for they are like our bread. They'll be like nothing to us. We'll eat them like bread. Their shadow, their protection, has turned away from them. It's not clear what it's referring to. The forces which protect them, they have no protection. And God is with us, do not fear. And then the people said that they should stone them. In other words, the people didn't want to listen, they wanted to stone them. And then the glory of God descended by the Ohel Moed, by the tent of meeting before these people. Okay, that's the case, Maharaj, my dear. Let's try and analyze it now. Where do they sin? Let's take Ramban's question. What do they do? It's not clear. Everything got completely out of control over here, but it's not clear what exactly they did that was wrong. Because they brought back a report, and they told the truth about these giants. And they were like, we were like grasshoppers compared to them. And these cities are very powerful. Everything they said was 100% true. They didn't make anything up. Now, however, Ramban says that if you want to say that the Dibas Ha'aretz, that the slander, they slandered the land, they spoke badly about the land, that was their case, but it says afterwards, they received Dibas Ha'aretz. However, he says, the sin began before they spoke badly about the land. See, they're very shrewd. Yeah, you have to realize if you're It's always much more effective. In other words, if you want to dissuade a person, you don't want to talk a person out of something that they really want very much or whatever, it's always more effective if you start off by speaking positively about it. It's more effective. If you come out openly, like outright, this thing is no good, this and that, so then the person's not going to listen to you. They'll say, oh, this person is just prejudiced. But when you speak, you see, they're very smart. If we just come back and say the land is no good, so then the people wouldn't listen to them. So they're very shrewd. They started off on a positive note that, you know, we are very objective. We're honest. The land has very good qualities. It's a land which flows milk and honey. Their first note was very, very positive. Then they began to use a subtle psychology. But the very first expression of rebelliousness comes right before it says that they vayaha. Right? There must be something that they did wrong, because Kalev got up to shush them. That's exactly what vayaha means, like shush. He shushed them. He intervened. Therefore, the Ramban concludes that the sin, the first part of the sin, took place before they brought out the slander of the land. In other words, between 27 and 30, they've already committed a sin. Wherein lies the sin? I'm sorry, look. In 27, they hadn't sinned yet. They were setting it up. That was to show them that they're honest and they have nothing, but just like you. We're objective. We're objective. It was deliberate, but that's nothing wrong. Vagam. That's even more. Everything God told us is true. It's a land which flows milk and honey. They're not going to come back and say that what God told us isn't true. That they couldn't do. Ramban says, however, FS. What does FS mean? FS is nothing. FS is like an expression of nothingness. FS. But in a very subtle way, you have to understand how effective subtlety is. FS. Yeah, it's all exactly. It's all meaningless. It's all meaningless. In other words, they got their hopes up. I'm telling you, it's a beautiful, beautiful land. It's fantastic. Look at the fruit. They're both from Earth. Fantastic. They didn't say so. At this stage of the game, they didn't actually phrase it openly. Just with a certain gesture, it's open up in a certain document. Ethic. And the Ramban, I'll quote you the Ramban. The Ramban, if you have Ramban there. Aval Rishayim, Risham rather, Aval Risham, their wickedness, the Milat Ethic. But the word, the very choice of the word Ethic, wrong word. Shimora al Dabar Ethic. That points out to something which is effort, which is nothing. The nimna and impossible. It's an expression of nothingness and impossibility. The nimna mina adam, which is impossible for a person to attain. It's unattainable. She efshar b'shumim, that it's impossible in any way. The kalashana effort when there's that chasba. In other words, what they said to them was, what they tried to do was to work on their emotions, to break down their hopes, and to break down any fantasy, so to speak, that they might have had about the land. You have to realize that, you see, it's not so simple. On the one hand, there are the emotions of fear and hesitation. On the other hand, as I said, I mean, people have a desire. They had a tremendous desire. They've been told about this land back in Egypt, and they're looking forward to it, and they want it, and that's going to give them the strength. You know, where does a person draw his strength from? You know, we're not all Moshe Rabbeinu, we're not all Avraham Avinu. So the average person will fight if he has a dream. I mean, he's fighting for something. He really wants it very, very badly, because he really believes this is very good. So what they did was to break down that whole thing. And they did it on, they operated on two different fronts. They didn't just come out openly and give a military report. It was a conclusion, as Ronit has pointed out. But they came back with a certain conclusion. When they toured the land, when they did everything they were supposed to do, and they saw the nature of the city, they saw the people, they were tremendously powerful. Okay? There's no question about it. They appeared by the appearance of the eyes to be extremely powerful and invincible. And they lost their courage. Right? They did not believe that it was possible to win. They were convinced that they would be destroyed. That was their feeling. In other words, they were overcome by fear. Now, the method that they used to dissuade the people was to play upon their emotions. It's a great land. It's a land which flows milk and honey. Effect, the Azam. But the statement itself is very, doesn't seem to be that bad. Seems to be innocuous. But the people are strong. That's what Moshe wants to know. Are they strong or weak? The way they phrase it, Effect. It's all for nothing. In that moment, they were communicating to them that it's all for nothing. It's impossible. We can't do it. And the proof that that is the case is the color sense. Color sense, the way they phrased it, the way they gave it over, was an attempt to break the bubble, to break to destroy their hopes, to destroy any sense that they could do it. That's why he shushed them. He tried to intervene at that very moment before it got out of hand. And he counted them. He was successful. That's phase one of the rebellion. And he said, no, what are you talking about? Oh, no, the irrational Israel. I was there too. I saw for myself. We can do it. Now it becomes an open battle. Because they hadn't said, now, the Ramban is right, because they hadn't said, the Spies didn't say anything that we can't. Did they say that we couldn't conquer? Where did they say that? They had said ethics. That word ethics was a message. Much more effective in coming out openly. So Kohler counted that. I know exactly what you're saying. Don't listen to them. We can do it. Then, you see, the proof that that's exactly what they were saying is to be found in 31. The men that were with him said, we can't go up against the people because they are too powerful for us. Now it's out in the open. Now it is out in the open. In other words, there's open dissension amongst the spies. You have the ten on the one hand, you have Yehoshua and Kalev on the other. And Kalev over here says, we can do it. We can conquer them. He's trying to maintain their sense of strength, their sense of confidence. Because once the moralization, timing is extremely important. Once the people is demoralized, they are defeated. In other words, people walk around with a certain sense of confidence we can win, a certain emotion. Now, if factors come into the picture that causes it to be broken and it's lost, you can't put it back together again. Very hard. It's very, very hard. That's why, psychological warfare and so on, every nation always uses these techniques to break down the will. So once the spirit is broken, it's very, very hard to put it back together again. Very hard to put it back together again. That's why, you see this even in recent history. That is part of Israel's military doctrine. That's why they always say with the quick strike, preemptive strike, they hit very, very hard, like in the Six-Day War, a lightning strike, and sort of knock out all the FTLs and the airplanes. And once they did that, the war was over and it was virtually won. The other, they threw them into pandemonium. The Egyptian troops and so forth, and the Sinaites, you're familiar with the history. Miraculously, you see, part of the other way, like conversely in 1973, if you remember, I know how many people remember, the Yom Kippur War, when Israel was attacked. In the early days, it was very devastating. But the miracle was that they were able to be true. Because there was it depends what you read. If you read Dayan's version or you read Sharon's version, everybody has, according to Sharon, he was the strong one. He kept them together. But he writes about demoralization, even amongst the generals. He said, we're acting in a totally demoralized way. And therefore, he says that they didn't exploit the forces. If you're familiar with the history. Yeah, that the generals had been so demoralized by that point that he was out there in the front. That's his claim, that they were afraid to take any. They were so cautious by that point. They went from one extreme of overconfidence to being so cautious that they failed to take full advantage, and it would have been a greatest victory, and so on and so forth. But the point of it is, nevertheless, we see that is another miracle, that even though there was a tremendous demoralization with the early losses, terrible losses in 72, they were able to recoup and get their balance and get their spirit back, and they went on to a great victory. So that's what they were trying to do. Khaled was trying to prevent that demoralization from setting in, and he was partially successful. This is round one of the battle of the 10 versus the 2. What does it say? Yeah, that's the spread out. It says that Khaled alone went to Fevron and spread out his body on the grave of the other, that he should not be betrayed. In other words, he prayed that he should not be seduced by his friends to be together with their conspiracy. Okay? Now, this, here again, as we've seen many times, is a Rashi which is not meant to be taken literally on the factual level. For had he known that there was a plan afoot and what their plan was, he would have reported to Moshe, even if he'd thrown it from him. Instead of the speaking story, they would have spoken to Moshe first, they never would have had his meeting. Guaranteed, had Moshe known, well, coming, he would have taken, he would have dealt, met with them privately. Sorry? They were very... Well, you see, you weren't dealing with 50 people, you're dealing with the 12 leaders. They were very smart. And they hid it. They hid it. They hid their cards. And had, their plan was, they were very shrewd. They didn't reveal it. One second. We'll take it step by step. I just want to, to answer the question of why Khaled didn't stop them, why Moshe, is because they hid their cards very well. They were very smart, and as you see, their opening statement was positive. So had Moshe met with them, they would not have revealed. Their plan was to hit the people, to attack the people. Now they know, had Moshe not allowed them, you see Moshe's position. A, Moshe may have had his suspicions on a certain level, but he certainly didn't know. He did not know what they were planning to do. Had he known, he would not have allowed it. And had Moshe not allowed them to speak to the people, that would have defeated the whole objective, and the people would say, well, what are they behind here? In other words, Moshe, God told him, yes, go along. Now, either you go along, or you don't. Now, the whole purpose of this is that the people will hear a first-hand report, and they will be convinced, and they'll be strengthened. Now, if you're going to hide from them, then they're going to say, of course, there's something wrong over here. Well, why aren't they telling us about the land? Then there's no way. The spies knew that. The spies knew that they would be allowed to speak to the people. And that was the place where they had an opportunity to... if they were going to sin, they were going to sin, and they were intelligent and true, there was nothing that Moshe could do, except once they put their card, Ephes. Now, Khaled was very brilliant. He picked up on the word Ephes. Ephes was not an open expression of insubordination. Right? But it was enough. He understood exactly. That's when it came out. That's when Khaled knew. That's when Khaled jumped in to try and stop it. And the first round did not decide the battle. At this stage of the game, the Jewish people now, had not risen in rebellion. They heard one version, FS, then they heard the other version of Khaled. And in other words, what the 10 were saying was that it's impossible. They're too powerful for us. There's no way we can win. Khaled is saying, absolutely ridiculous. Of course we can win. Because it's not in our power, it's a question of God. In other words, if God wants us to go, then God can do anything. We have to have a moon, we have to have faith in God. And he reestablished their strength. Yes! Yes, isn't it true? We were overpowered by the Egyptians. How did we ever extricate ourselves? It wasn't us, it was God. And then by the Amsuk. I'm not saying he said these things, but that's the message. That's the message. That is all you've seen, that everything that's happened to us, going back to Egypt, can only be explained as a result of God's protection and the war against Amalek and so forth. Wow. So he counted them. Yes. He himself was afraid that he might become seduced by this. Well, there must be a very powerful, powerful danger over there. It's very scary. Very scary. Now, what happens next? At this stage of the game, the attitude of the Jews was not completely determined. And I'm going to explain this according to the interpretation of the Ramban, and basically says ended in a draw. And so Khaled shushed him. It doesn't mention that Yoshua. It doesn't mention Yoshua himself. One second. Oh, as he said like this. In other words, I'm reading the Ramban now. I'm on the Ramban on the words, and Kalev shut them up, shush them. He quieted them and said, we can go up. For we will be able to manage it, conquer it. He said, it is true that the people are very strong, he agreed, but we will be stronger than them, and from their fortified cities. Then, after doing that, the Meraglim explained what they meant. Then the Meraglim countered him and said, no, we can't go up against the people because they're too powerful for us. He's saying, in other words, like this, they were saying no, that even the nation, even if they were to come out against us in the open field, we would be able to go up against them to fight them. Certainly we won't be able to conquer. No, there were two arguments. First of all, the people themselves are too powerful for us, even if they were to fight us on the open plain. And certainly when they're in fortified cities, that's just impossible. That was their argument. Then it says like this, all right? Then it says in 32, all right, so you have an argument here. You have Kalev is saying we can do it, and the other guys are saying we can't do it. Impossible. So what's next? And then they brought out their heavy ammunition. They brought out their heavy ammunition, which is Dibasa, all right, they slandered the land that they had explored. Alright? And Ramban says that what does it mean they brought forth the slander against the land? He says they left Moshe and I. Now the group broke up. That's where the meeting ended. The group broke up. And they were saying, then they went back to their tents, and that's where they said that it's a land which eats its inhabitants. Because at the beginning, when they spoke before Moshe, they said the land flows milk and honey. It seems to be a contradiction. First they said it flows milk and honey. Right? Except all they said was that the people are very powerful. And Kalev counters that by saying we can overcome them. So, there were people that went along with Kalev. And they had Amunah and their strength and their power. And in other words, like this, what Ramban says is that the initial attempt of the Meraglim camp did not intimidate the people, because amongst the people there were those who believed in Kalev. Kalev says we can overcome them. So there were people that had confidence in their own strength. There were people that had confidence that God would help them. So the initial attempt of the Meraglim did not succeed. Then they came forth with the Diba.